Let's have an AA meeting. My name's Tim R., and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting on NABA Zoom, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from page 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language and from their own point of view the way they established their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our NABA Zoom room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, will hear tonight's speaker, and we believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. And tonight, Brian B. from the Fifth Tradition Group will be our speaker, and he's a dedicated member of the Fifth Tradition Group. I see him in other meetings. He is a true AA, and I think I first met Brian. He introduced himself to me when I was helping to organize an acoustical coffee house at NABA, and he was all about service, wanted to serve, and boy, he showed up, and he delivered the goods, and so here he is tonight, and I'm pretty sure he's going to deliver again. Here you go, Brian.
Thanks, Tim. I'm Brian. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Brian.
Hello, everyone. Thanks for asking me to speak tonight. It's always good to have an opportunity to set myself aside for an hour and talk about myself at the same time. Somehow that's what we wind up doing, I hope. At least that's what I hope I wind up doing. My sobriety date is December 1st, 2015. As Tim said, my home group is Fifth Tradition Group. I do have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I sponsor other men. I want to really talk about my experience in getting sober this time, which was 5 years ago. There was a lot that led up to that, but that's really the miraculous portion of my story. One, that I survived, and two, that I made it back and got sober. I got sober for the first time when I was 20, going on 21. I think I picked up a 90-day chip on my, right around my 21st birthday, the first time I got sober. And it was, just due to, you know, getting busted with the goods at the house by the parents and being told to get help. And I had always had this sneaking feeling, this suspicion that what I was doing wasn't right. That, you know, the drinking and getting high and you know, that stuff was not really what I was supposed to be doing. And I was really lost, before I started doing that. And I got really lost after I started doing that and just went along with what other people were doing. You know, they wanted to drink, I drank. I wanted to do something else, I did something else. Not a whole lot of different things, but, you know, whatever was available. But alcohol was definitely my thing. By the time I was 18, I was keeping, you know, a bottle under the car seat in the car, in the front seat, under the seat, and, usually some orange juice too. And I'd just mix a drink. I'd have some cups in there and I'd just mix a drink whenever I wanted. And that was normal to me. It felt like, you know, something I deserved, you know, that was just the way way that I took care of myself, or whatever. But I was really quiet about it. You know, one time I remember I was working in the grocery business for years in the supermarket. And, early on, I remember, in my partying days, somebody said, "Oh yeah, I hear you went out and partied with so-and-so last night." And I was like denying it. Like I didn't want people to know that I was some party guy. I had this image to uphold, I guess. But when I did get sober, you know, I got right into meetings, right around when I was 21. And, you know, I immediately felt like for the first time I was at home. I totally felt like from the first time I was at home. I mean, they felt the way I felt. You know, they felt like they didn't belong in the world. They drank the way I drank. You know, once they started drinking, they couldn't stop. And when they weren't drinking, they were trying to figure out when they could get a drink again. And, you know, their lives had gotten twisted and messed up, and they had put them back together. And, you know, I felt like that was where I belonged. I related to the stuff, the way they felt, and I related to how they drank, and I related to how they, had this misplaced feeling of not belonging in the world somehow. I couldn't stop drinking on my own power. But somehow through the power of the fellowship and some sponsorship and kind of working the steps, I managed, you know, not to drink for 25 years the first time. And I can't tell you exactly what it was that kept me sober during that time. I know, you know, I had a connection to the steps. I had a connection to the program, and it sort of faded after about 12 years. I did a lot of service work. I had a lot of fun, lots of fellowship, a lot of meetings. There was a lot of people to call and talk with about whatever was going on. I never had a shortage of that. And, you know, I thought that was what sobriety was supposed to be. And nobody had told me any differently. And if you talk to anybody that got sober in Atlanta in the late 80s, I'll tell you it was kind of like that everywhere in Atlanta in the late 80s. That a lot of people just, not everybody, there were very few, you know, groups and people that were like, yeah, let's go through the book and let's get through these steps. And, you know, let's talk about, you know, your spiritual program of action and all that kind of thing. I didn't hear a lot of that. It was a bunch of people who had stopped drinking and were spending a lot of time together. And we had a lot of fun. You know, we used to have, I was in charge of fundraiser dances for a long time, a couple of years, two or three years. And yes, people did used to go to dances and they were a thing. And people had a lot of fun, and we raised a lot of money. We had a talent show one time. I mean, it was just, you know, a lot of cool stuff that you see, you know, some of the stuff you still see around now, but definitely not the same. But, you know, after I kind of drifted away, you know, it's because I'd gotten married and had a kid and was I was working a lot. I was in management at the supermarket by then. I was working 50 plus hours a week, odd hours, evenings, weekends, that sort of thing. And really busy with home and family stuff too. But at the same time, very selfish and self-centered and lazy and, not present and just really, you know, anytime I could relax, I relaxed. Anytime I could, you know, escape through watching movies or TV or whatever it was, you know, I would do that. And, you know, I was not, I was not fully sober. I was dry, but I wasn't fully sober. And there were a lot of miserable times in that time for me. And there was I had no solution. My solution, was to try to get back into the program. You know, things weren't going well. Things weren't going well at work. Things weren't going well at home. So I'll go back to the meetings, you know, I'll get reconnected. So I tried several times to do that. And, usually they kept me away from home more, and that didn't work out so well. So I wound up, back in, away from the meetings again, but I would get a sponsor and I'd try to start working the steps again. And, I wasn't committed to it either because I didn't think it was doing anything, or I just, you know, I hadn't gotten drunk, right? I didn't have the desperation, the dying man has. And, you know, until I did, you know, I had gotten really depressed, I could point to all sorts of reasons that kept me sober during that period of time. I could say it was, you know, medication and, you know, being busy and all that. Who knows exactly how I managed to do that, but it was completely on self-reliance, very little reliance on God. I might have had some sense of principles, but just enough character and just enough character, you know, just enough to get by, like it says, you know, in the 12 and 12. I mean, that was my, that, I was that guy for sure. And it got to a point where I was just so down and so miserable, and just, I was, you know, sleeping in the guest room and watching TV all the time when I wasn't at work, and that was, and sleeping, and that was it. Like, that was my whole life. And one night I was at work, and I was in management. The other managers had left for the night, and I thought it would be a really good idea just to take a break from being sober and drink for a little while. So I stole a bunch of alcohol while I was working, started drinking at work, and I was drinking in the office, hiding it and stealing it and taking it home. And, you know, it was really easy to do because nobody was paying attention to me, right? I'm just over here stocking the beer, you know, no big deal. And I worked out ways to get it out of there without being caught, and didn't ever get caught. And wound up, you know, drinking and driving and all this sort of thing. And, you know, it says, like it says in our book, it says, you know, the thoughts don't crowd into our mind to think about, you know, how we can affect our lives by doing that. You know, the desperation and the humiliation and the degradation you know, it says weeks or months, but for me, it was, you know, a long time ago. And I didn't see that that was going to be something that would be harmful. I thought it would be something I'd do for a while, and I'd just come back to AA, right? Because I know how not to drink. I'm that guy. You know, I didn't drink for a long time. I'll just do it again. Well, it didn't work out that way. I wound up being drunk around my kid, who was around, I guess around 14 or 15 at the time, maybe 16. And, you know, just wound up leaving, moving out, because, you know, I was like, I didn't have the, you know, I threw all the stuff away and got a white chip and came back. And then, you know, a week later drank again. And, you know, being a true alcoholic, when somebody says you can't drink and live here, I thought that meant you can't drink all the time and live here. Not like you can't just drink one more time, because it was only one more time. It wasn't, you know, all the time. And I managed to stay sober after that. It was right after, I had 25 years at that time. I just picked up a 25-year chip. I went to some meeting that I used to go to, and I picked up a blue chip and gave a little speech. And, you know, it was 6 weeks later, I was drunk. And when I came back, I landed at this group and found a sponsor and was, you know, going through the steps. And you know, he took me through the steps kind of really quickly, sort of like in the parking lot outside the meeting, after the meeting, and it was a daytime meeting, and we would go out in the parking lot and go do a little bit of step work, and I got through them fairly quickly, and it was not very detailed, any of the fourth step or the inventory or any of the fifth step or amends or anything like that, but I, you know, I kept going, you know, and I just thought I could stay sober. I thought that was enough to stay sober for me, and it wasn't enough for me. You know, I wound up getting involved in a relationship when I had 90 days, and it didn't work out. And I was completely miserable about that and brokenhearted and all that kind of stuff. You know how we get. And I didn't have anything to fall back on. I didn't have a program. I didn't have a spiritual program of action. I didn't have people. I didn't have a network. I didn't have you know, my sponsor, you know, was not, you know, guiding me away from that or anything like that. And I started, you know, like getting these physical weakness and tiredness and all these things. I mean, I had several occasions during the time when I was sober that long time that I had these physical manifestations, which were probably alcoholism, of being weak and tired and having, you know, leg pain and joint pain and muscle pain. And you know, I went through this 1 year, I felt like I was walking through jello all the time, but I'd like pushed my way through this. So I had some similar stuff to that, and wound up having to leave my job because I just couldn't do it anymore. Physically, just could not go in and work. And after about a year and a half, you know, I was completely miserable again. You know, I left the job, and I was thinking about leaving the job, and just like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And I had these thoughts about God were about not. You know, I didn't think of myself as agnostic. I was raised Catholic, and I didn't really believe, you know, follow any of that anymore. But, you know, I believed that there was a God, and I believed that the God was powerful and all powerful and could help. But, For some reason, I didn't think he would be able to help me. I'm just so far beyond help. God couldn't even help me. That's how, you know, conceited and egotistical I was about it, and really didn't feel like that even if that he could, that I couldn't do what he needed me to do for him to help me. Like, I just can't even do it. So I attempted to end my life, and I failed to do that, and didn't have any physical or mental repercussions from that. But I did lie on the couch for about a week with the TV on, and the guy I was rooming with at the time would bring me an insurer in the morning, and when he got for work, and when he got home, and my sponsor's response wasn't what I wanted to hear. So I got a different sponsor, and I had a few sponsors, and I was going to the phone group that I have now at this point. And, you know, still did, you know, the steps, not fully honest, not fully open-minded, not fully willing. They were, you know, I wasn't telling somebody everything that was going on with me. You know, I was doing these odd things that, you know, you would tell somebody about, like when your friend, you know, has a situation where he's got to get all his rifles and pistols and ammunition out of his house, and you have a big trunk, and you both decide it would be a really good idea if you just put all that stuff in your trunk and drive around with it for God knows how long and not tell anybody about it. You know, this is it seems, you know, completely insane for me to that I would have ever done that. But at that time, it didn't seem odd at all. And, you know, just not even thinking about consequences that could have happened. Nothing happened from that, but I did, you know, take my car to the shop and leave it there, and they were driving it around, and I got pulled over, and they asked, you know, you got any guns in the car? No, sir. You know, and I think I went to my sponsor's house to do a fist step, you know, with that going on, and didn't say anything. We'd get in hit and runs and drive away in the rain. Some guy was chasing me in the rain one time. I stole from my employer. You know, these are things that I did, you know, in sobriety, air quotes, like this is the kind of life that I was leading. And I drank again, surprisingly. And I got to stay sober a year and a half again, and wanted to drink again. I wanted to drink and I wanted to die. I didn't want to live anymore. I just, you know, the things had fallen apart again. You know, my job had fallen apart. I just drifted away from the meetings. I had an impasse with a sponsor. There's another thing that happened. I had this impasse with a sponsor. He was talking to me about making amends, and he was like, "You have to pay that money back. That's their money, and you have a budget. You know how much you have." And I was like trying to explain to him that the job that I had was commission. I didn't know what my commissions were going to be, and instead of like trying to, you know, go to his sponsor about it or go to somebody else about it and say, how do I talk to him about this? I just wrote him off and said, I'll go work with somebody else. And I got me a nice, easy sponsor, right? He didn't even write out his 11th step at night. This is great, you know, and I'll go to this meeting over here. And they'll be nice to me, you know, because I really don't like the people at this meeting I'm going to. You know, they really don't accept me, and they don't invite me to do stuff. And, you know, I'm not happy there. So it turns out the people at that other meeting were just as judgmental and unloving as the people at the group I had been going to. They were exactly as judgmental and unloving as other people are. And I was being very judgmental and unloving to them as a result, or probably it was just me that was being that way. And, you know, I wanted to drink again. I wanted to drink and I wanted to die. I drank and, I was contemplating my demise, and, I had an opportunity to rethink it. And you know, something just came to me. So let me check on some things. And I checked on some things, and I said, well, maybe this is not a good idea. Maybe I should give this life thing, sobriety thing, one more shot. And I was completely miserable. I mean, I didn't feel like I had anything to live for. I mean, I was down, you know, to the, I since I decided I wasn't going to be around anymore, you know, I'd written all kinds of bad checks, and I'd let, you know, quit working and let all the bills pile up. And when you're not around anymore, you know, gone. I went to bed that night, and I got up the next morning, and I called the one friend that had been trying to keep in touch with me the whole time. So if you're that guy who's that one friend, or that gal who's that one friend that maybe is reaching out to that person that you don't see, you know, you might be the lifeline for them. This guy was a lifeline for me, and he had been one of my good friends in AA, and is still one of my good friends in AA. And I'd been there for him when he relapsed. I sat with him at the hospital when they were taken into Petra. They had to take him to the hospital first, and he called me, and I went there and sat there with him. They made sure everything was okay. And he drank again after that. Now he's been sober like 4 years. But he called a couple of guys. He said, "I can't come. Let me call a couple of guys." Well, this one guy came and he got me and took me to a meeting, and I picked up a white chip and I asked the guy to be my sponsor. And it turns out the two guys he calls, it was the two guys I trusted the most, but the one that came was the guy that I trusted felt most comfortable with at the home group, the tradition. It was the guy that, you know, that I felt like, you know, was the, you know, it was, you know, it was my favorite guy there. You know, we'd been friends. We, you know, met for coffee and dinner and stuff like that. You know, so it was somebody I felt comfortable with. You know, so if you're that guy or that gal that's wanting to go and meet people outside of meetings and have coffee and connect to people, please keep doing that, because that might be the thing that brings somebody back in and saves their life. You know, it was, everything was falling apart. You know, I didn't want to go back to the meeting. I didn't like you people with your jobs and your houses and your apartments and your cars that had valid tags and insurance on them and your bank accounts with money in them. You know, I was nothing like you. And you know, he came over and worked the steps with me, and I had to force myself to find ways to get to meetings. I had to, you know, make a point every day. I wasn't working. I was sitting at home watching TV all day. I didn't know, you know, there was nothing else that I could do at that time. And would have to, you know, contact guys every day until I could find somebody that would be willing to come over and get me to take me to the meeting. And people were willing to do that. All kinds of people came and got me and took me to the meeting. I got to know people that way. And I had to call three people a day. And I called those three guys every day. And one of them is I talk to twice a week still, 5 years later. One of my closest friends. You know, I went through the book with this sponsor with this idea that maybe I didn't know as much about AA as I thought I did, right? I thought, well, I've been here before, and I was here before. I was here for a long time. You know, I know what this stuff means. I understand it. I'm pretty smart. You know, I can figure it out, and which is the way I ran my sobriety and my life into the ground more than once, two or three times. And maybe I should have to look at it from a different perspective. Maybe I should just go into it like, I really don't know anything. I don't know anything about this. I'm going to let this guy tell me what he did, and I'm just going to do what he did, because, you know, he seems to be reasonably happy. He seems to have a good life. He's got good things in his life. He's built, you know, something for himself in his life, and he's content. You know, he's got some contentment. And he's involved in this group, and he says you should do service commitments at the home group. You know, I did that. I didn't want to go back to the meeting. I didn't want, you know, somebody said something in a meeting the other night that I'd never heard before, but it was exactly the way I was thinking about it was, I don't want, you know, I remember being so angry. I was saying, I don't want those people looking at me. I don't want them talking to me. I don't want them even thinking about me. And somebody shared in a speaker meeting one night that they were, you know, the people in the meeting were thinking at them. It's like they were thinking at me, right? Because they're all thinking about me, right? Because here comes Brian again. He's not going to make it. And he's, you know, he's rambling up here again, you know, with his funny walk. And he's going to come in here and, you know, not get sober. But we'll let him in because, you know, we let everybody in. We always welcome back the prodigal son. Hey, Brian, come on in. Yeah, right. Y'all don't want me here. And I went anyway. And, you know, I had to do a lot of praying around that. And my sponsor asked me to pray in the morning. And he asked me to pray in the evening. And he asked me to pray for me to be able to love the people there the way God wanted them to be loved. And I didn't know what that meant. I didn't know what that looked like. And I didn't know what that was going to look like. But I would do that every time I went to the meeting, especially when I was feeling incredibly anxious. And I couldn't sit still. I was getting up every, you know, half hour through every meeting to go outside to smoke cigarettes. And, you know, I couldn't stay in my seat. And he said, I'll give you 90 days. Like, do that for 90 days. And after that, try to calm down. And we continued to go through the book. And when it said pray, we prayed. And when it said write, I wrote. And I did it the way it was outlined in that book. And we talked about a lot of, spiritual concepts. And he talked about the way he applied them in his life. And he asked me to do the same. And we got to the fourth step. And there's this anger prayer in the fourth step. And it was probably a little time after I did that step. But I was working at this job. I had this great sobriety job at a burrito place at night. And I had this terrible commission recruiting job that I knew the guy that I was working at during the day. And it wasn't terrible. He's a good guy. And he really helped me a lot. He would pick me up and bring me in the office and then take me to my job at the burrito place at night. But I still didn't like him, right? Because I didn't like his personality. And I used to hate to see that man coming. He's going to say something to me and I'm going to try to, have this verbal sparring and get him to shut up. And I used that anger prayer in the fourth step and about this is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God saved me from being angry. And opportunities came up for me to be helpful to him. And I didn't want to be helpful to him because I didn't, he was pissing me off. And I found some ways to help him do some stuff around the work that we do. And I felt better after that. I didn't dislike him as much as I did. And I got along with him better. And he didn't bother me as much anymore. So I got to see some of the program working. And I told my story at my home group when I had 7 months sober and a 15-minute speaker. When we're in person, we have a 15-minute and a 50-minute speaker. And I was a 15-minute speaker. And, I told, kind of a little bit about what I'm talking about tonight, up to that point, right? Because I'm up to that point now. So I'd probably be done now, except that took like 20 minutes already. But anyway, this guy comes up to me at the meeting. I was at the literature table that night, and he's like, he's about my age. He's like, hey, man, can I get your number? I said, sure. And so I gave him my number. I'd never seen him before. And he calls me the next day. And he says, man, you told my story last night. I have 24 years, and I feel like I'm going through the same thing that you were going through. Will you take me through the book? So I got this guy with 24 years calling me at 7 months saying, hey, will you take me through the book? I'm like, I don't know if I can do that. And talked to my sponsor. And my sponsor was like, yeah, I know that guy. We used to go to meetings together in this other town, and I've known him for a while. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. So I didn't know what I was going to do, right? I think I might have, started taking a couple of guys through the book at that point. So I just went and met with a guy, and we went through the book and we swapped stories. We'd read the book a little bit and we'd swap some stories. We'd talk about our experience about, AA and the book and the things that are written in the prefaces and the forewords of Bill's story and all that. And, we met every week and did that. And my sponsor kept encouraging me to invite him to stuff. It's like, bring him to this thing, bring him to that thing, bring him to the roundup. The Atlanta Roundup was happening, that summer. 2016, and my sponsee was speaking at that 9 o'clock speaker meeting over there in Dunwoody, and I'm like, I'm not going to ask him to go to the freaking roundup at 9 o'clock at night. He's like, bring him over. So we got the roundup, and he runs into this guy that was his sponsor years ago, or somebody that he used to connect with years ago, and eventually got connected to his original sponsor. And from that, he got reconnected, into AA. And as far as I know, he's still sober and doing well today. And the guy was so humble about it. They had this paper on the wall and people writing like sponsorship line circles down the wall. And there was somebody's name on there and somebody wrote, Bill W. And then this guy and then this guy. And he saw his sponsor's name on there and he put, or my sponsor's name on there, and he put my name, and then he put his name in the circle below that. And the guy was just so humble about it. And I don't tell that story about this is some great thing that I did. It reminds me of the promises. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. Even if my experience of telling somebody, hey, you don't have to go through what I went through, to get this. Or it could be telling somebody, hey, even though you've gone through this kind of thing, similar to what I've been through, you can still get it. And AA has proven that somebody like me who has done what I did and gone out as many times that it was about time that I had, that sobriety is still possible and a happy, useful life is still possible. And I did finish the steps with my sponsor, and he's still my sponsor today, and we still talk weekly. I have a call set up with, I've talked to him almost every week for the past 5 years. I think I might have missed 2 weeks. I called him every day, of course, at first, and or at least frequently. And, you know, we continue to talk about the spiritual program of action. He'll tell me to go back and read 6 and 7 sometimes, or used to, and I'd read it and I'd say, that sounds ridiculous. I don't make declarations. I will never give this up. You know, this isn't, you know, a stage production of my life. You know, I don't talk like that. And then I went back and read it a year later and I said, now I see what that is. And I read it later and it means more. So, you know, the 12 and 12 is kind of like, you know, as I get further down the road in sobriety, I can read more into what I'm doing with the steps and I'm sharing with the newcomer, and I keep it, in the big book. And, you know, and I made, you know, I made, I, most of my amends were financial. The defects that came out in my, inventory were more about, you know, I didn't really feel like I had any resentments, and I kind of dealt with some of the amends, you know, the personal amends already in previous this step. So, you know, we did a lot of work on, you know, my defects around people who annoyed me, and we got a lot of good information about that. I learned a lot about myself, about how I see others, and usually, you know, it's that you spot it, you got it thing. The stuff I saw in them, I was the same way myself. And, you know, it was, when we finished that fifth step, I felt like, you know, the dimmer switch had turned up on the world. I'm one of those people that had kind of an experience with light around the steps, and I saw and felt and experienced everything a little bit differently. That day after we finished, you know, the fear and sex inventory on that last Sunday of the inventory after 9 hours of working on it, together. And, you know, that man spent, you know, 9 hours of his life sitting in on his lawn talking to me in the summer of 2016 or the spring of 2016, 5 years ago, this month, next month to do that. And, gosh, you know, how grateful I am for that. And, you know, my life, you know, slowly has changed since then. The financial amends were crushing, you know, fear, people, and economic insecurity will leave us. It tells us in 12 and 12, the 9-step promises. And, you know, as I was making those amends, you know, those things didn't leave me because one of the reasons I didn't want to live anymore is because I didn't think I could pay back everything I owed then, let alone, you know, what I added up when I thought I wasn't going to be around anymore. And over the past 5 years, I've chipped away at that. I've chipped away at it. You know, when you come in like I did, when you've got nothing going on, all I had was AA, and all I could focus on was AA and program and meetings and service and fellowship and you know, whatever I could do to be around people and to do service in AA and get to meetings and try to work with others. And you know, that gave me a foundation for life, you know, and the jobs get better. You know, the next job was a little better and the next job was a little better. And you know, and then it gets to the point where, okay, well, I really got to take care of this one. This is a big amends. You know, I owe a lot to this person. It's a personal debt that needs to be repaid. And I was able to come up with a plan and I paid it off. It was, it was a lot, you know, and I paid it off in 2 years. And then, as other ones, you know, come up or, you know, I get, you know, the creditor calls me or whatever, you know, and then I, you know, I say, oh yeah, I can pay that now. And then they're almost gone. They're almost gone. You know, it was probably, I found the sheet the other day and I think it was, you know, it doesn't matter. It was more than I made in a year. My first year sober, I'll tell you that, that I owed. And, it'll probably be gone this year. And, you know, everybody is prone to financial insecurity. We're not alone in that, but it seems to hurt us more. We're also prone to, you know, getting into, you know, situations where, you know, we get into sobriety and get into, you know, I'm prone to it too, getting into relationships, the form established in sobriety. And, you know, I chose, you know, not to do that this time. I chose to wait until, you know, I was established and met somebody who was, you know, on the same path as me. And that, you know, it's working out really well. So what it's like now is that through all that discussion and prayer, seeking guidance, you know, my sponsor doesn't guide me in, with specific things so much. He'll say, ask me to pray about something. Or to ask to be shown or to seek action in a certain way. I was really getting frustrated with people I worked with at one point, a couple of years ago. And he said, try treating the people that work like you would the people in your home group. If somebody in the home group needed something, you wouldn't be an ass to them and feel defensive and all that. You would just say, okay, well, how can I be helpful? And I started trying to put that into practice. And, you know, I was stressed about work. You know, it was annoying. You know, people were annoying. Of course, everybody annoyed me. And, you know, no, people stopped being annoying. I stopped feeling defensive. I stopped acting defensively. I started feeling more at peace. And, you know, seeking to be of service and turning anything that I'm doing into a way to be of service turned out to be one of the greatest things for me, and, you know, of service to God and others, to set myself aside and say, you know, how can I be of service in whatever new, because right, I still get to live my life. I mean, I come in here and, you know, I read through, you know, I don't know however many pages it is, 80 pages before I get to the third step and kneel down at the coffee shop with my sponsor in front of God and everybody and say the third step prayer, and I'm like going to turn my will and my life over to God. You know, my life doesn't change immediately. I don't immediately start living this, you know, God-centered life. I get to still live my life, and I get to bring God in more and more over time. And I find that the more I do that, the more ways I find to bring it in. And, you know, and to take it out, you know, to bring it back in and that sort of thing. But it becomes this established connection that the book talks about, where, you know, we making conscious contact with a God of, with a higher power, with a God of my understanding, and asking for his will and the power to carry that out, and thinking about my day and how can I bring God's will into that. And it's easy to know, that's not always easy to know God, what God's will is, but it's easy to know what it isn't. And it's easy to think along the lines of, you know, how can I be of service? You know, thy will be done. And that's, you know, I love that line, because then it says it's the proper use of the will. And I'm like, wait, you know, the first 100 times I read that, I would think, wait, what is the proper use of the will? I got proper use of the will. Let me look back at that again. Oh, it's that. Okay, well, I'll do that then. And the experience of that has been incredible. You know, I prayer and meditation in the morning and doing the nightly inventory. And just making a habit of it, making a practice of it, while still seeking to be of service in AA, still seeking to work with new people, still seeking fellowship, you know, in whatever way that we can get it, now that this is here. You know, I got the opportunity to be involved in, a service capacity, with Zoom at my home groups. So I have one of the few service positions that I can be very active in my group during this time, and I'm so grateful to be connected that way. I'll end in a moment. I wanted to talk about what Bill Wilson talks about when he says, you know, he talks about being rocketed in the fourth dimension a couple of times. He talks about it in his story, and he talks about it a little later in the book. And to me, that being rocketed in fourth dimension, the fourth dimension to me is time. It's the present. It's, you know, people, you hear people say things that they don't refer to that particular passage or that part, you know, of the program, but they'll say, you know, that God lives in the moment. You know, we say one day at a time, one moment at a time, one thought at a time. You know, what is it? You know, if you want to drink, just say, I'm not going to drink, you know, today. Well, if you want to drink, say, you feel like drinking, say, well, I'm not going to drink for the next hour or the next minute or the next second. And over time, you know, that type of practice puts me in being in the moment. When I first started doing that, I would just be so distracted by something. You know, something's not right in my life. I got to, you know, this is not right. This, that's not right. I'm not going to be able to fix that. You know, what am I going to do about that? And, you know, I'm at work, right? And I'm like, well, I think, well, what am I supposed to be doing right now? Where am I? Well, I'm at work. Well, what do I do for a job? Well, I do this. You know, I look on these names and numbers on the computer, and I call these people and I ask them questions, and I try to, you know, do what this company has hired me to do. So, okay, well, I'm just going to do that right now. And to have that, you know, that puts me in the moment. It takes me out of me and focus. And that's what I think is, you know, when I'm trying to be of service in my life, you know, when I'm doing a task or doing my job or seeking to, whatever it is that I'm doing, how can I be of service? You know, the more I do that, the more peace of mind that I have. You know, in the practice of doing that, the practice of the prayer and meditation, in the morning and thinking about my day and doing a nightly inventory. No, I don't always come up with all these revelatory things every morning and every evening. But the practice of still keeping doing it keeps me, you know, on the path. It keeps me on the beam and talking to people about what comes up, talking to my sponsor about what comes up, talking to those friends that I have that, you know, will listen to me talk for a lot longer than my sponsor will, in great detail about every single thing I'm thinking about something. And then something may come up. You know, we're just having a conversation, and something may come up and say, well, this, you know, this is something that I can, you know, pray about or act on or do differently or seek to be a different way. And, you know, I don't always feel the presence of God, but I often feel, you know, a connection to God. And I believe that God can help me today. And I believe that no matter, you know, what, I can do what God needs me to do to stay sober and to do what, you know, I need to do for him to be able to help me. You know, we're all kind of, it's an individual journey. We all kind of are on the same path, but we're all having our individual journeys on these paths, on this path. And, you know, we still get to walk it together. And, you know, it's the broad highway. You know, it's the fellowship of the Spirit. It's the road of happy destiny. You know, it's the, all those things that are written about in the big book that, sound really corny when I first hear them, but then as I experience this, it makes sense why they called it that, why they mentioned those things, why they refer to them in that way. You know, the realm of the Spirit is, you know, broad, roomy, and all inclusive. You know, I can exclude myself from that if I want, and I have, but I don't have to. So thanks for letting me talk tonight. I feel a whole lot better. I hope you do too. Thanks.
Thank you, Brian.
I do feel better, Brian. Thank you. Thanks for focusing on the solution, really sharing what worked for you and continues to work for you. Congratulations.
Brian, thanks for sharing your story. Really meant a lot. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Cynthia.
You sure do look better than when I first met you. And it's just a pleasure to hear your story after what you've been through. So, three cheers. I'm glad that I'm glad we're friends.
Thanks, Gary. Me too. It's the tweed jacket that really makes me look better. Nothing else.
It's the hats over your shoulder that make you better, Brian.
Yeah, hats. The hat.
There you go.
I'm Benjamin, an alcoholic, and I'm actually never, I've been to a plenty of NABA meetings, so I've never been to this exact one, and I just want to send the same sentiment. Brian, you might not always hear God speak, but I heard things God wanted me to remember and hear through you speaking tonight, so I really appreciated that. You know, it's just, it's so impossible to keep this thing green on our own, and, you know, I always hear guys say, play the tape forward. And for me today, it's all about emotional sobriety. The obsession drinking drug has been lifted from me, but that emotional sobriety is just like the physical sobriety. If I'm not working this program and I'm not staying connected to my higher power, who's God, you know, it's all for naught. Have measures avail us nothing. So I appreciate your story very much. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Brian. Just wanted to say really enjoyed that. It was very inspiring.
Well, I hope everyone comes back next week, we have a guest speaker from Philadelphia by the name of Roanne D., who Robert B. of the Fifth Tradition Group, and also the Quarantine and Sober Group at NavaZoom.com. He helped me set this up. Roanne D., she's got a great recovery story as well. I'm looking forward to that. We got a good lineup for the rest of the month. The week after that, Jim M. from Auburn, Alabama, just celebrated 60 years, and he is quite a energetic young man for 60 years of sobriety. So he'll keep us on the edge of our seats. And then a newcomer who's always been very active in service throughout her first year, just celebrated her first year. Jenny W. is going to lead off our first Monday in April. And then Mike B., who's familiar with a lot of folks, has served on the board and is president of the NAVA Club. And very humble guy despite all his high achievements. So we got a nice month ahead of us. And thank you, Brian. You delivered the goods just like I said you would.
Strange to me, as I rode from town to town, can't put the bottle down, right now feels like it's killing me, life out here gets so depressing, need something to take the edge, you see. Inside, it's the bottle, the book, or the gun for me.